But who knows, will 2012 mark the last high water mark of British civilization before a gradual decline? Or will it be the start of a new British Renaissance? Who can say? But it's certainly been quite a remarkable year, hasn't it? The Olympics, the Paralympics, the Diamond Jubilee, and all kinds of other things. Extraordinary year, even though in December's wintry gloom, it seems a distant dream, doesn't it? But 60 years on the throne is an extraordinary milestone by any measure. And to top it all, the year ends with the news of a royal baby. And guess what? On top of that, the Queen gets to go to the cabinet. I mean, it can't get much better than that, can it? It's surely enough to melt even the stoutest of Republican hearts. But why celebrate this event with a jubilee? It's a funny old word. Even though it's been associated here in this country with anniversaries and milestones for several generations. And you might think its origins are obvious. I mean, it sounds like jubilation. And so it implies sort of pervasive moods of general jollity and happiness. But actually, it's a very ancient idea, and it goes back far, far further than British history. It goes back to ancient Israel and to an event that would happen, in theory at least, and certainly as mandated by the law, it would happen every 50th year. In other words, after 49 years, or seven batches of seven, there would be the 50th year of the year of Jubilee. And it essentially represented a brand new start. The cancelling of debts, the restoration of properties lost, the freedom given to those enslaved. In other words, it offered every generation, once in a generation, one institutional second chance. Now, it's obviously a far cry from the principles of Western capitalism, and no doubt any economist sitting here tonight will be able to give this a serious critique and say it could never work, and that's not how the world is. But economics aside, I guess that it is something that after the credit crunch and the euro crisis and all kinds of other financial crises that we are beset with, it's something that perhaps millions in today's world would be hugely grateful for, don't you think? A relief, a second chance, the opportunity to begin again, the chance to learn from mistakes. Of course, cynics dismiss that. As the philosopher Hegel once said, the only thing we learn from history is that we learn nothing from history. But just imagine if the Queen's Diamond Jubilee had been that kind of jubilee. Not just an extra bank holiday this time, but a totally clean sheet with debts cancelled. Now, that would have driven the national mood sky high, don't you think? Now, what's this got to do with Christmas? Well, in fact, everything. Because our readings and our carols have been pointing to one thing. Nothing less than a royal jubilee and a divine one to boot. Now, you know, of course, that in Christian tradition, giving presents is very ancient, and so are baubles falling off the tree. Happens all the time. It's been going on for centuries. But giving presents also goes back to the idea of those ancient astrologer philosophers traveling to bring gifts to the newly born Jesus. But actually, it goes back even further than that. And our Isaiah reading makes it clear, written centuries before Jesus was born. Just have a look down at verse 6. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given. And my wife was a midwife for a number of years here in London, and she never tired of that moment of delivery, despite all the stresses and the dangers of the whole birth process. The start of a new life is simply breathtaking. It feels miraculous. It almost demands to be called miraculous. Every birth feels like a gift, because there's a sense in which every birth is a gift. But Isaiah seems to think that this birth will be extra special. Now, he has no doubt that this birth is of a boy who will be in line to the throne, just as William and Kate's children will be. He says in verse 7, he will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom. Now, David was the greatest king that Israel ever had, and through all the ups and downs of their turbulent history, he was the sort of great talisman of former glory. And to occupy his throne carried huge national significance, just as perhaps in this country, Edward the Confessor's throne up the road in Westminster Abbey has for us. But here's the extraordinary thing. The claims for what this baby will achieve, this king, are extraordinary. Of course, on royal occasions, people seem to reach for exaggerations and gush with sentiments all the time. You see that from royal correspondents on the news all the time. But Isaiah goes far beyond the sort of gush and flim-flam. He sees that this birth is a gift from God himself, with world-changing consequences. Just see that verse before, in verse 5. Every warrior's boot used in battle, every garment rolled in blood will be destined for burning, will be fuel for the fire. We've been uniquely fortunate in Western Europe. Despite our turmoils and problems, we've enjoyed the absence of war in our lands for around 70-odd years. It's an astonishing thing. And yet we take it for granted. Very few generations have known anything like that. But there's nothing guaranteed about it now for the future. And of course, it hasn't stopped us being involved in all kinds of other wars elsewhere, almost seemingly non-stop. But this verse seems to promise something far greater than a period of peace. It's about the end of war, full stop. It stands alongside other passages in Isaiah which look forward to the destruction of weapons and the return to peaceful living. It is a grand hope. But in the light of history and reality, a rather forlorn hope, wouldn't you say? They promised that the First World War would be all over by Christmas. But it ended up with such horror that it was declared to be the war to end all wars. Neither prediction was right. War certainly hasn't ended in the 21st century, let alone in Isaiah's time. So perhaps we should simply consign Isaiah to the dark ages of ignorance and just plain wishful thinking. But this is where the biggest surprise comes in. From imagining walking around the battlefield piles of smouldering weapons there in verse 5, we're suddenly whisked away, transported to a sort of Galilean maternity unit in verse 6. And the claims made for this kid seem frankly absurd. This is not the birth of a reincarnated Dalai Lama leading people to enlightenment. Nor, in fact, is this crown prince going to triumph like Alexander the Great. In fact, he's going to be far more awesome than any of them. Look at those four titles in verse 6. Very familiar, perhaps. Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Now, those are outrageous names. We lived in Uganda for a number of years, and I had a number of friends who were called Emmanuel, which from Isaiah 7, if you know that chapter, it is the word given to this boy who is born. Emmanuel means God with us. Now, not for one instance did I imagine that all my friends were God with us. It was just a sort of name of piety. It didn't mean much more. And it was a nice name. But these names go far beyond just piety and devotion. I mean, take the easy ones first. Wonderful Counselor. That literally means, I suppose, a supernatural or miraculous advisor. It reminds us of the wisdom of David's son, Solomon. This baby will rule with divine wisdom. And then he's called the Prince of Peace, not just as in the absence of war, but the Prince of Peace as in shalom, completeness, wholeness, health. This is a royal baby who will fight to make everything whole again in its right place. A restoration of God's whole world. That's quite something to say. But then we get those middle two. Mighty God, everlasting Father. I mean, that is far more than the zeal of devout parents, isn't it? That is treading very close to the edge. Make no mistake, this is a claim for this child's identity. An infant with the strength and power of the Creator, a newborn who's everlasting. Talk about paradox. This baby on David's throne will therefore be the one to bring divine wisdom, divine power and might, divine fatherly protection, and above all, divine shalom, peace. Which is why he can be trusted, in the words of verse 7, to bring everlasting government that will be absolutely just and perfectly righteous. In fact, this birth is God's greatest gift because it brings the ultimate jubilee. It brings relief to those whose lives are full of regret and anxiety. For those who have things in their lives that they know are wrong, but about which they can't seem to do anything. We've all got skeletons in the cupboard. We all have people we've hurt, things we've done or not done. And sometimes Christmas time is the hardest time because it brings those things to the surface. And the truth is that we've all lived in God's world while treating it as our own. But this is the wonder of Christmas, the gift of Christmas. There is a jubilee, not just once in every generation, for one nation back in the dark ages of history, but for every generation in every nation now. It's not about turning over a new leaf like those sort of feeble New Year's resolutions. This is a new life offered by this baby king who grows up to rule as Lord of Lords and King of Kings. He offers forgiveness and a new start forever. And that is ultimately the peace he brings. Of course, wars have not stopped in the last 2,000 years. But get this, countless millions have made their peace with God through him. That is why we do that rather peculiar and even rather disturbing thing tonight of celebrating Jesus' birth by having a memorial in the middle of the night to his death. Very strange, and yet right and proper. Right and proper. As that other great carol we're not singing tonight, but Charles Wesley has it in Hark the Herald, Jesus was born that man no more may die. And for us to escape death, he had to die in our place. That is the miracle of God's mercy. To offer hope and freedom through his life, death, and then life after death. Of course, that'll seem very far-fetched if you've never encountered this before. But perhaps the fact you're here tonight, who knows why many people have come tonight. It's great you're here. We're thrilled to see you. I guess we have a myriad number of different motives and reasons for being here. But perhaps if you've never really thought about this, perhaps you can begin to see why people get so sort of caught up in Christmas. It's not the tinsel, it's not the prezzies, it's not the parties and family time, good though all those things are. But the reason people get so excited about it is because it takes us back to that moment when the world first set its eyes on God's greatest gift to us, his Son, our eternal King. If true, that has to be of supreme importance, doesn't it? It changes everything. If it's not true, it is of no importance whatsoever, and we should go home now. As C.S. Lewis once said, the one thing, though, it can never be, is of moderate importance. It's all or nothing. So all I ask tonight is we meet together, we come round the table a bit later to take communion, to remember Christ's death in our place as we celebrate his birth this Christmas. Investigate further. Deepen your understanding. Ask your questions. Talk to your friends. Pick up one of these free little booklets that we've got called The Real Christmas. I've got a whole stash, and I'm very happy to give one to you on the way out tonight if you'll read it. But whatever you do, don't ignore the majesty of this Jubilee birth and divine gift. In the meantime, I wish you a very happy Christ-filled Christmas and a Jubilee-shaped New Year. Amen.